Well, hey, this is Dave. I wanted to dial in a little early to be sure I wasn't missing any gossip before we got started. How's everybody doing?
Doing well.
Hey, Gloria, welcome. Here. Doing good. I was typing away. I'm sorry. I'm typing in everybody's ear. I didn't notice there was anyone on.
Well, super.
Oh, didn't hear it. Well, we were thinking about your state this morning as we watched the horrible mass shooting yesterday.
Yeah, I know.
My gosh, you guys have had your share of stuff.
Too much is going on. How's everything? Are you all settled after the fires in California?
Yes. Well, we are, and fortunately, my daughter's back in her home, and her home was spared, even though the fire was incredibly close, within a block on one side and a mile on the other side. So, everybody's doing well, and I bet you were happy the Astros brought you guys home a nice win.
Yeah, that was super, absolutely super, and that was a nice follow-up for all the Hurricane Harvey stuff on my street, actually, houses at the end of a cul-de-sac. Three got like 13 or 14 inches of water. We were spared here at the ranch, you know, a little bridge damage. But, yeah, a lot of stuff going on.
I know. Well, I'm a San Francisco Giants fan, but since they were not in it, I was really pulling for the Astros.
Well, good. It's okay to get there by default.
Absolutely.
Hey, well, I want to welcome each of you. It's great to be back together, and welcome to the rookies in current training and here for the first time. The first half, I want to do a brief announcement at the beginning and the discussion of professional fees that Lisa Minyaki has been nice enough to do a survey, and we'll do that. I'd like you to be thinking about the questions that you have about professional fees, setting and collecting, for us to discuss as we move into that the first half. And as you saw from the emails in the second half, Dr. Srini Pele will be here to discuss Tinker Dabble Doodle Pry. So first, an announcement, because I know she's not able to be here today. Jamie Meyer passed with flying colors the certification for the International Consortium for Health and Wellness Coaching, ICHWC, and made us all proud. And the certification is available to anybody who's done the training, New Life Story Wellness Coaches. And they're doing another round of exams in June. The application will be in January. Our program is one of a handful of programs nationwide, primarily academic, that are accredited to qualify you for the exam. So, other announcements, other wins and progress notes before we move into our discussion about fees. Don't be shy. What you got?
Hi, Dr. Dave. It's Naomi.
Welcome, Naomi. How are you? Do your full name and where you are so that everybody will know about you.
Okay. My name is Naomi Jones, and I am from Staten Island, New York. And I was able to do my first conference in this a couple of weeks ago, this past October. So that was pretty exciting. So that was a
super. What was it on? What was your title?
My title was The Mindset Reset Experience. And it was called Start with the Vision.
Super. Congratulations. That's great.
Thank you. It was really about trying to use some of those principles that we know about how to set your vision and then set your plan after.
Well, that's great. If any of you are doing a workshop or a retreat or anything like that and would like any help or just to chat about it, let me know. As you know, I've been doing in the last year or so a bit more of that sort of thing. My wife said, "Dave, you just have to take off your headsets and get out of your easy chair and get out there and do some stuff." And I did, and it's fun. So I'm accumulating some experiences with workshops and retreats, and have some. And I'll be happy to share with you any experiences that I've learned. One of the things that was most beneficial for me before I did one in Boston almost a year ago and the retreat in California on New Money Story at 1440 Multiversity that I'm going to repeat was the book TED Talks. Can I get a management of background noise? You're not hearing it, but your microphone is picking up everything that's happening, any kind of movement or shuffling. TED Talks is written by Chris Anderson, the guy who put together and owns TED. And it's a compilation of all the stuff that he's learned that makes a great talk and engaging. In the 18 minutes that TED Talks are known for, but it's tremendously useful for whatever kind of presentation you're doing. I listened to it two or three times going back and forth really before each of the things I did. So it's really useful. So thanks for that, Naomi. What else?
Dave, could you say again which TED Talk that is?
It's all on the one I got is on audio because I wanted to talk to me since it's going about talking. It's just called TED Talks, and it's by Chris Anderson. It's on Amazon on audio on one disc. I think there's a book also.
Okay.
But I would highly
Chris
recommend.
With
it. Really
Chris
useful. Yeah.
Chris
yeah. Who else?
This is Kip.
Hey, Kip, welcome. What's going on? Bring us up to date.
Well, I was listening to some of the folks earlier, and it's great to hear such progress and interest and energy. And I know you're aware that I've just gotten an agreement with a medical outfit to do well-being resilience training. And I was able to, get a fee of when you first mentioned it to me, I choked on it, but $500 an hour plus travel, half of it for travel, and they didn't bat an eye. They just.
Let me interrupt you one point, Kip. Can I get a mute on background noise? There's your microphone is picking up some noise in the background. You're not hearing it probably, but if you could mute if you're not ready to talk. Go ahead, Kip. Sorry for the interruption. Now that you've got the $500, let's start talking some real money. The guy that I think most of you have heard this story. A buddy of mine who had started a consulting firm after he left a senior position at IBM had a tremendously successful firm, and he flew to Houston when he knew I was starting my coaching practice, and he said, "Dave, do you know about the gulp factor?" And I said, "No, Art, tell me what the gulp factor is." He said, "Well, you say the highest fee that you can possibly say without gulping, and, of course, that's going to increase over time, so your gulp factor, Kip, is just starting. This is bedrock. So go ahead now that I've interrupted you twice."
Well, the amazing thing was that there wasn't really any concern on their end about the amount. It was just more about getting it out there, and they just seemed to want to know what it was rather than, finding some way to get it down. So,
people buy a state of mind, and when that state of mind is confidence, they want to participate. And they know you're going to bring value because you know you're going to bring value, and it's going to far exceed X number of dollars per hour or per project. It's going to be exponential. So that confidence is exactly what you're selling, and that's terrific.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, go ahead. Was there more?
No.
Well, this is PJ Gunter, and I'm new to the group.
Hi, PJ. Welcome. How are you?
Thank you so much. It's delightful to hear about the achievements and the accomplishments. Naomi, yours, and also yours, Kip. And I'm down here with Dave in Houston. We've never met. But
down the road a piece, we've never met.
I'm just down the road a piece. So I'm calling myself now a financial wellness practitioner. And I was inspired to adopt that title after going through the new money story materials. So I just wanted to say how excited I am to be in your company, and I hope to make a significant contribution.
That's great. And PJ and I are hatching some plans to do a series of Unity Church retreats So that's going to be exciting. Well, who else? What's going on? I want to move into our discussion about fees quickly, but I want to hit any highlights about WINS progress notes, book releases, anything else going on with you guys.
Hey, Dave. Hi. This is Lisa Manyoki.
Hello.
Hey, Lisa, go ahead.
Just so you know, I just read this article, the Chris Anderson article yesterday. I will send you the link. It's from Harvard Business Review, and it's how to give a killer presentation, and it shows examples of some of their best TED Talks.
Okay.
So I'll send that one along. It's a great – I have the book, too, but this one's different because it actually has – pictures of some of the examples that they're talking about in the book. So
that's great. I
already sent you the link
to our group too. Thank
great.
You very much. There was someone who spoke at the same time. At least we're going to come back in
yes.
a minute for the fee.
Hi.
Someone spoke at the same time as Lisa.
Yes, that was me. I'm sorry, I tuned in late, and I can only stay for about half hour. This is June Radicki, and I'm calling from California.
Hey, June, welcome.
Hi, thank you. I'm not calling to report anything at this time, but I am interested in listening and picking up whatever I can. Thank you very much.
It was great to have you. A lot of time. Super. Anyone
thank
else?
You.
Hi, Dave. Hi,
this is
Archie.
I'm sorry I missed both of those.
This is Shelley.
Yeah, go ahead, Shelley. Hey, how are you?
Okay. Good, how are you?
Great.
Hello, everyone.
Shelley Lecker, Hollywood family coach.
Thank
just
you.
Go ahead.
Well, I'll share something exciting that has to do with also what I learned because I did your retreat up at Mulberry, which I'll do again, actually. It was on the Money Story, and it was really amazing. So
see
I've
you
been
on October 18th.
October 18th? Okay, let me put it down. Good to know. You know, and by the way, it really was amazing. And the information just keeps unfolding as it is. So I've been mentoring.
Your check is in the mail. Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you. I've been mentoring some girls, a specific group of girls, and what it is the requirements that they happen to have is they've gotten themselves through college and they've done all the work they can, but they come from incredibly poor families. So they have a mindset of being that they'll never have anything, even though they've done this job of getting themselves through school on their own. So I was working with two of them about a new business opportunity where they were going to pitch something to somebody I knew. And we were talking about fees and money. And so it was really interesting to get these girls to see that they could make more than they could as a waitress. And they ended up pitching and landing a $26,000 job where they create a book for someone that I know. So a family that I know. And so that was really exciting because they were dying when they landed it. And they worked really hard to land it. But so thank you, Dr. Dave. You're helping lots of people.
Dynamic news. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
I appreciate that.
Thank you.
One more. There was someone who spoke at the same time as Shelley, and I didn't hear.
Hi,
Katie's here.
Hi, this is Audrey from Virginia.
Audrey, go ahead. And there's still someone. Go ahead, Audrey.
No, I really don't have anything to say. I just wanted to let you know I was on.
Dr. Audrey Pullman, wellness coach,
yes.
Welcome.
Yes.
And who else spoke?
Katie Stepp in Albuquerque.
Hey, welcome. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
You're super.
Lots going on. I thought one little piece I'd add about that, the TED Talk piece that you mentioned. I watched that too. It was great. I watched it right before. I did a TED Talk probably 3 years ago. I did a TEDx, and if those of you who don't know, there are approved small organizations within, actually, we shouldn't say small, but not the big TED organization, but they're sanctioned by TED, and they're called TEDx. And it's not really very hard to get, I shouldn't say it's not hard, because it can be competitive to get in to do a talk with those. But I did one here in Albuquerque. It's a really thriving TEDx community here, and I did one about 3 years ago, and it was fabulous. It's the best thing you'll ever do, and it's gives you a video that's professional afterwards and practice. It's really enjoyable, so I encourage anyone to go out and find it.
That's super, and congratulations on that. It is no small feat to do a TED, TEDx, or any kind of TED presentation, so that's absolutely super. I want to do just one quick announcement since it's in response to some questions and then move to our discussion about fees. Some of you have asked about this over time, and I'm finally able to do it. I wanted to announce a mentor coaching supervision group that I'm going to do for a limited number of people, just people who I know and invite, beginning January 17th, Wednesdays, the first 3 weeks of each month, Wednesdays 1 p.m. Eastern. And it'll include resource materials like white paper and reference guides, but it's mostly just a small group of people getting together, discussing cases, and doing group supervision. So it's kind of a development of group wisdom and mastermind and learning together about cases that may be challenging or may be beneficial to discuss. So would anybody shout out what specifically you'd like to be sure we include in our discussion about fees before Lisa does a summary of the fee survey? Anything that you want to include, just in a succinct phrase or sentence, what you'd like to include?
David?
Yes.
Hello? It's Lori Bunting. I wasn't able to chime in and say that I'm here. And I'm here mainly just to listen and learn, but I just wanted to say hello to everyone.
Okay. What do you guys want to include in a discussion about fees and setting and collecting professional fees?
David, this is Jerry calling from Connecticut. How are you?
Yeah.
What I would like to include is overtime. So say you have a constant, you know, client or a group, and when you do you raise fees, when and how, or, you know, that's something I would like to add to this.
Okay. Okay. What are the questions? Just succinctly throw it in the pot.
Well, this is Kip.
Yep.
Yeah. How can you know what the range to charge is with any different group? Do you need to benchmark that and try to figure out what it is that most folks are charging or what groups are paying? What's the first steps there?
Okay. All right. Great. Got it. Good question. Other question.
It's Marguerite O'Neill.
Yes. Hey.
From Canada. My question is, if you have a group coaching session, such as mastermind group, what fee would you charge for that?
Okay. Now, those are two questions. One is group coaching, another is a mastermind group. And those are two distinct entities, and we'll come back to that.
David, I have a question. This is Allie Cottle from L.A.
Yeah, welcome. Hey.
Hi. So I haven't ever coached before. I'm just doing this to learn, obviously. And what about when you're first starting out as a coach and what you feel like your value is? That would be my question.
Okay. The answer is, what do you plan to charge 10 years from now and start with that?
Okay.
And that answers the first one about what when you raise fees to everybody. And you do the same, you don't have to keep up with a whole bunch of staggering things and long tails and whatever. It's when you set your fee, you set your fee for everybody. That's my view. But let's get some real data now. And Allie and Shelley, you guys need to meet each other, both being Hollywood coaches and having a history in film and a whole number of background issues. I'll take care of that.
thank you.
So, Lisa, would you summarize what our group gave you in terms of feedback?
Yes, definitely.
However you'd like to.
I'll give you the highs and the lows and just some general observations. But after this, I will gladly share this report with our entire group. I'll send it to you, and you can forward it. I wish I could give everyone some solid information that they could use as a benchmark, but the results of this survey of only 15 participants showed prices all over the map. The question about hourly rates, the lowest hourly rate charged is $50 an hour for clients who had been grandfathered in from a prior commitment, and that jumped up to $75. And then the highest hourly rate was $500 an hour. The people who responded with monthly retainers halved after that. Most people did not have one, and the lowest a monthly retainer was $444. The highest was $2,250. So there were answers between ranges in each category, and there was no sense to the selections. There's no criteria for them. They were all over the place. So I then the next question was on half day and full day, and the lowest for a half day was $1,500, highest was $2,500. For the lowest for a full day was $2,500, and the highest was $6,000. For scaled hourly rates, only a couple people answered this. $250 was the consistent answer for executives, $150 for non-executives, and then one individual offered a charge of $50 for college students, but only as a group. And then only one individual says that for executive monthly fees it's $2,250 and $1,000 for non-executives each month. So the general observation is pricing is elusive and a lot of guesswork. And I think based on the package answers that came later, there is zero consistency to any length of time, dollars charged, et cetera. So, again, I can share the results and give you the specific answers, but they don't really give us any solid benchmark and criteria for charging.
Okay, thank you for doing that, Lisa, for compiling it, sending it out, and going through that whole process of composing and interpreting it. And I think what you found reflects exactly the state of our profession. I think that is an exact mirror of that. Even those of you who have gone through this licensed specialty certified training, it's still a question and it's still all over. So, Lisa, any thoughts or any recommendations or conclusions that you have in addition to what you've mentioned? Any recommendations to the group?
Yes. I also did this for another larger organization, and the answers reflect the same trends, which is new coaches are timid about charging anything, trying to justify lower rates as that they're inexperienced. But from those who I coach and mentor about business development, it is very risky to charge low rates and then increase them because it trips resentment switches later or raises an eyebrow to say, oh, my, you know, what happened there or what didn't happen. So the temptation to charge low, and you said it earlier, is definitely unwise. When it comes to retainers, the retainers are easily dividable by X amount of hours. So I know, Dave, we've talked about this in other curriculum prior, that coming up with a $1,500 and you're meeting four times a week, most consumers will just divide by four. So there needs to be a way to better explain a retainer rate, especially when the numbers are flat and easily divisible by a number of sessions. In another group where I ask the same questions, many people who answer it bounce around and don't actually name numbers for fear of collusion. And I know I ran this question by you, Dave, because I didn't know how to answer when this one client asked, but there needs to be some way for each of us to educate where we even begin, how we arrive at these rates, and is there a benchmark? Is there something that's appropriate? Just trying to base your rates on what you think someone will pay is a greater crapshoot than this already is. So my advice is that we need to educate each other and advise us on just some general benchmarks of what's worthy of the contributions we make. I do wager that most of these fees, even from the 15 who answered, are too low.
Yeah. Okay, thank you very much. There's a, it occurs to me, and I should have sent this out beforehand, there is a blog that I did for Coach Training Alliance on the most common mistakes people make, new coaches make, in setting fees. And I will find that and forward it to you. Some of the most common are charging too low or feeling that you need a full practice before you charge your full fee, or charging based on where you're located geographically, or any number of things. And as Lisa mentioned, and I feel a little rushed because Srini will be joining us in about 5 minutes. So let me hit a couple of highlights, but interrupt me if you have questions or if you have additions about what you'd like to add.
I have an addition, Dave.
Go ahead. Just succinctly, Karen, if you would.
Pardon me. Okay, I will. One of the gold nuggets that I've gotten for you over the years was to really think about the resentment number. And I think Lisa just mentioned that too. But another thing, and I'll keep this very quick, and then maybe if you want more about it later, you can let me know. When I wrote my last book, one of the things I did is pulled out client files for years, and I wanted to answer the question, what brought people to financial recovery? I got the response to that, and it was about people wanting to improve their relationship with money. But the other thing that I saw were the clients that I had on both a personal spending plan and a business spending plan had dramatically increased their earning. And so I don't have time right now to go into how that happened, but it was really, really striking.
Okay, great. Thank you. It seems right now that this is something to be continued and for us to pick up and discuss at our next mentor group, but I want to address some of the questions that are right now on the table. And if you want to continue this, just let me know, because it sounds like there are some things that we have not gotten to. As most of you know, I recommend a monthly retainer that covers each of the coaching weekly sessions, the standing time, plus whatever material you send, plus whatever communication you have in between time, because that reflects the nature of the work that we do, that it's a process, not a distinct event, you know, like a massage therapy appointment, and you're done, and a month or two later you come back and you don't think about it in between. And to set those, as Lisa mentioned, fees that are not divisible by four, because if you set it at $1,600, somebody's going to immediately divide by four and say, $400 an hour, that's a lot of money. And not, so set it at $1,575 or $1,625, and not make it something that ends in big zeros. There are two neuroscience studies that show a couple of things, including left digit bias, which is why there's so many things that are $9.95 instead of $10. To avoid the big zeros. Charge what you're worth. Charge what the value of the work is. Start with where you want to get to and not have a staggering rate of beginning at something and then working up 3 or 4 months later. But charge what you began with. 12 years ago when I began mentor coaching, I had one, if things were simple back then, I had one monthly mentor coaching retainer, and that was $10.50. Now, things are a little more complex now, and I have different rates, but charge as if you're full. Charge exactly what you feel you're worth. I'm sorry, was there a question? I think Srini is with us or about to be with us. Let's continue this next time, and we'll pick up with things that we didn't get to, including about a group and group coaching and mastermind groups and that sort of thing. I will ask you to send me any questions or observations or things that you want to add next time to me in an email prior to our next quarterly meeting so that we can organize this and have a more meaningful discussion about setting and collecting fees, benefits, various systems and that sort of thing, because I think we need to consider a number of things. I will send to you the blog about the most common mistake that new coaches make in case that's helpful to you. So I know this is a to be continued, and we didn't get into the depth that we might have. And thanks again, Lisa, for the survey and the summary of the survey and the work in that, to each of you who participated in the survey. Let me check. Is Serena here? Not yet. He's joining us. He's from Boston, but joining us from the West Coast. So is that Serena?
It's Serena, yes. Hi,
hey,
David.
Welcome. Hey, let me do a brief introduction, and we're good to go. I'm really happy to introduce a colleague who's a best-selling author, a Harvard neuropsychiatrist, and an executive coach. Dr. Serena Pillay is on teaching faculties at Harvard Medical, Harvard Business, and Duke Corporate Education. He's on the cutting edge internationally of integrating mind and brain sciences to personal and professional applications. His last book, the one that you read for this discussion, was influential to me both in content and in process, and for the new book I began. This is when I began to think about how beneficial it might be for each of you to personally engage with him for your professional coaching practices to hear and interact with him. Serena and I first met as two of the five neuroscientists featured at the annual Brainathon in San Diego. He's the real deal, though. Serena is somebody who is truly and authentically lives, writes, teaches, and dresses as a dynamic tinkerer. Welcome. It's a privilege to have you with our group.
Thank you so much for having me, David. I'm really happy to be here. Interested to know how I can be helpful.
Well, great. Let me begin with a couple of questions and then have our group interact with you after that. First, in your book, you highlight some problems with focus, and that's something as professional coaches we traffic with daily. How can coaches explain to clients what the dangers of focus are?
So I think as a coach, one of the things to first say to clients is that focus is absolutely essential, that we cannot do without it if we want to complete our tasks on time, that we cannot do without it if we want to go deeply into any subject, that focus is absolutely essential. But the problem is the way that people currently live their lives is they live their lives with focus, focus, focus fatigue. And by the end of the day, they've drained their brains completely. So what we need to do is learn how to build unfocus into the day. But before you actually sort of try to explain that to them, I think that there are five particular disadvantages of focus it would be good to describe. The first is that focus causes brain fatigue. And you literally can say that to your clients. There was a study in which people asked one group of people to watch videos, the other group of people to watch videos as usual, and the other group of people to watch videos with intense focus. And after that, they asked them
if they would.
So the first, and I can still hear some feedback.
Let me ask again, would everyone except Serena please mute? I don't have my dashboard in front of me to do that for you, so you'll need to do it. Star six. Yeah, let's try it again.
Okay. So I was saying there was a study where they asked one group of people to stare at the video with intense focus and the other group of people to look at the video as usual. And then they gave them a moral dilemma where they had to help people. And what they found was that the group that focused intensely had no interest in helping anyone else. They were just completely exhausted. And when they fed them glucose, they found that they started to care again, indicating that focus depletes the brain of energy and that if you just focus the entire day, you're probably going to care less about your work and you're going to be less engaged as well. The second disadvantage of focus is that focus creates tunnel vision. So although it's great to just look straight ahead at what you're doing, in your life, if you don't take time to unfocus, you actually have this tunnel vision. And a classic example of this is Anne Wang, who invented the word processor. And when IBM was saying that the PC was the next big thing, Anne Wang was focusing on developing the second version of the word processor, did not pay attention to its competition, and as a result became bankrupt. So we want to be aware of what's going on around us. And as a result, focusing entirely might prevent that because it causes blinker vision. The third thing to say to clients is that when you focus and you have your nose to the grindstone, you actually are not paying attention to future trends. So robots, for example, are taking over a lot of jobs. They're not just taking over jobs that involve data processing. They are delivering food. They are flipping hamburgers. They are actually becoming sports journalists. And a lot of people are predicting that middle managers within companies will be largely replaced by robots. In fact, doctors and their diagnostic abilities will also be replaced by robots. So if you're not paying attention to future trends, you're not going to adapt to the future. And so even though you have your nose to the grindstone, you're going to ignore what's coming your way. The fourth disadvantage of focus is that it actually keeps you trapped. And as a result, you don't make connections. So a classic example would be Albert Einstein, who had a think tank, and he, in his think tank, decided to study the mathematical theories of Poincaré. Now, a lot of people would say, well, why should a physicist be studying mathematics? That's not his primary field. Well, by studying Poincaré, he was able to ask questions that had him then extend the theory of relativity, extend Poincaré's theories by two steps to develop the theory of relativity. Even more bizarre sounding is that Picasso was also someone who had a group of avant-garde literati. And Picasso also studied the mathematical theories of Poincaré. And on hearing about the fourth dimension, actually invented cubism and painted one of his most famous paintings, La Demoiselle d'Avignon. So focus can actually help you proceed ahead, but it does not help you make connections. I think a classic example in business would be Gillette Corporation, that had a toothbrush division, an appliance division, and a battery division, but failed to take a battery-powered toothbrush to market first because each division was operating in a silo. The fifth problem with focus is that focus compromises your sense of self. And, you know, for me, one of the most exciting definitions of leadership is Warren Bennis's definitions, which is becoming a leader is synonymous with becoming yourself. It is precisely that simple, and it is also that difficult. Now, the problem with focus is that it activates the brain so that it activates the LinkedIn profile parts of you. You know, maybe your gender, your age, where you worked, what you do, but that's not truly who you are. You know, for a leader to become themselves, there are a lot of intangibles that need to be part of their identity on a day-to-day basis. So metaphorically, focus is like a fork. It invites just these solid, obvious LinkedIn profile pieces of your identity to the table. But unfocused invites other forms of silverware as well. It invites a spoon to put the delicious melange of flavors of your identity, like the scent of your grandmother. It invites chopsticks to make connections across the brain. And it also invites a toothpick to basically go into all the nooks and crannies of your brain and pick out the fragments of memory that are such an important part of identity. So those five reasons, fatigue, tunnel vision, being blind to the future, not making connections, and compromising your sense of self, are the reason that focus alone is not good enough in the way in which you structure your day.
Now, that's so crucial and so elegantly said. So how can we, as coaches, help someone with focus but also incorporate unfocus to balance?
Yeah, I think when you suggest that someone needs to unfocus, their first fear is that they're going to be unproductive. And so I think you need to assuage that fear by helping them understand that even though the brain occupies 2% of the body's volume, it uses 20% of the body's energy when it is at rest. And effort adds on just another 5%, suggesting that 98% of mental activity in the brain is unconscious. So if we don't learn how to interact with the unconscious, then we are not tilling the soil of the unconscious. And so the tree of focus that grows from the unconscious is not going to be stable. So we ask, well, is there a way you can build unfocus into your day? And there is. There are a lot of different ways. In fact, the book outlines a bunch of different ways. I'll highlight a few things. The first is called positive constructive daydreaming. So, you know, when Jerome Singer has studied daydreaming since the 1950s, and he found that slipping into a daydream is not helpful. Ruminating, like over the last night's indiscretions, perhaps maybe when you had too much to drink, is not helpful. But positive constructive daydreaming is helpful. And the key to this, the basics of this, are three things. Firstly, plan it in your day. Secondly, be doing something that is low demand. It doesn't work if you're just sitting at your desk and staring into the air. You need to be knitting or gardening or walking. And then the third thing is start with positive, wishful, and playful imagery, which essentially means, you know, think of anything that for you is wishful or playful, like lying on a yacht or possibly running through the woods with your dog. Whatever is playful or wishful, and then practice this. Now, the first thing that people say to me when I say this is they say, I don't have time in my day to daydream. And then I share this fact with them, which is that we all spend 46.9% of our days daydreaming. So if we are spending more than, you know, close to half of our days daydreaming, why not learn to daydream in a more effective way? And that's what positive constructive daydreaming is. I think the other piece to this is sort of other forms of unfocus would involve things like napping. Now, immediately I say this, people say, but that's going to look like I'm not actually doing my work. Well, the reality is that a lot of companies have now established napping pods in their offices. People like Google, like Zappos, have actually established napping pods so that people can nap. What's interesting is that 5 to 15 minutes of napping will give you 1 to 3 hours of clarity, which is, you know, quite a lot to do. So I always say to people, if you're thinking about building this into your day, choose a time when you would naturally be in a slump. Usually that's mid-morning, directly after lunch, mid-afternoon, or at the end of the day. Sculpt out 15 minutes so you can revitalize your brain. And if you need to nap, why not nap and then get 1 to 3 hours of clarity rather than drag yourself through the day and drain your brain progressively? Studies do show that in order to be more creative, you need about 90 minutes of napping. But the reality is that that's a little long for most people's work days, so maybe that's something you can try out on a weekend. With one caveat, studies have also shown that too much napping too frequently can stress out your heart, and that's because it affects the quality of your sleep later in the day. So I would say the most robust recommendation to make is a couple times a week, 5 to 15 minutes of a nap that will revitalize the brain by giving it 1 to 3 hours more energy. The third technique would be doodling. So even as you're listening to me right now, perhaps you can take out a pen and start doodling, because Jackie Andrade and her colleagues found that by doodling, you can improve memory by 29%. The fourth technique that I'll mention is psychological Halloweenism, which is essentially based on a study that showed that when you pretend to be an eccentric poet, you are much more likely to be creative than if you pretend to be a rigid librarian. And the same people, when they exchange roles, actually still maintain their creativity if they pretended to be an eccentric poet. And I think this speaks to the fact that, in general, it's not that we can't solve problems, it's that we get stuck in our own habit pathway, something that I call habit hell. And to the extent that we can escape those habit pathways, it's important to be able to take on another identity. And I've run this in workshops, I've done it with people, and it works really well when people start to think in a different way. And then the last thing I'll mention is walking, which is a pretty simple exercise that you can do as part of lunch or directly after lunch. Studies show that walking outside makes you more creative than walking on a treadmill, and it also shows that walking on a meandering path makes you more creative than walking around the block. So I think it's really important to remember these different distinctions. And, of course, the book is filled with lots of other things like possibility thinking and a bunch of other ways in which you can build unfocus into your day. And what I say, start slow. Choose 1 or 2 periods in your day when your brain could do with being revitalized. Try out one of these methods and then measure your own productivity, because not every method is going to work for every person. But by learning to build unfocus into your day, you are actually giving your brain a chance to put puzzle pieces together, something it would not otherwise have the chance to do if you simply just go through the day without any period of unfocus.
terrific application of the material in your book. One more quick application question, then I want to open it to our group to interact with you. How would you think about coaches incorporating Unfocus to enhance meaning and purpose for someone?
Yeah, you know, I think what a lot of people don't recognize is that the real sensation of meaning and purpose is something that feels inspired and something that emerges. So when people say my meaning and purpose is something, or if they name their families, or if they name a particular cause, it's not that that's not true. It's that that's simply described. Well, firstly, you know, outside of the family context, if you just have a social purpose, it can often be virtue signaling, and you could be robbing yourself of the opportunity of actually discovering your purpose. So the first thing that I would say is when you're explaining meaning and purpose to people, it's important to say that there's a kind of spontaneity that we're looking for, and we're looking for an integration not just of coherent narratives, but of fragments of information to come to the fore. And by practicing these different techniques, it stimulates the brain so that these fragments of information actually do come to the fore. And when people resist unfocused, I think Kierkegaard partly explained this. What he said was that anxiety is the dizziness of freedom, meaning we say we seek freedom, but actually freedom feels like we're without gravity. And as a result, we tie ourselves up in balls and chains so that we can feel grounded, but eventually we actually feel trapped. So I would say that the way that unfocus relates to meaning and purpose is that meaning and purpose is made up not just of our coherent narratives, but of fragments of information in the brain, and you cannot activate these fragments if you are simply focusing throughout your day.
Wow, super. Well, I want to open it up to our group. I know I've gotten so many responses about how incredibly useful the book was. What would you guys like to ask or talk about with Srini while he's with us?
Yes. This is Gloria. Hi. Hi, everyone.
Hi, Gloria.
I got your book a couple of weeks ago, and I was in the throes of creating a webinar or a courseware on forgiveness. And, oops, I'm sorry about that. Let me just stop it. Okay, on forgiveness. Yeah. And so I've used some of the concepts in the book, just telling people about it. And so really self-forgiveness, I do like EFT every evening before I go to sleep, emotional freedom technique, and just simply to forgive myself for whatever I did or didn't do during the day. And it really has helped me sleep. So I was so excited to read what you wrote about this.
Great. Well, thank you. I think forgiveness is such an important piece of how we relate to ourselves and also of progress, because the reality is that the world is changing at such an incredible rate that it's impossible to make it through without making mistakes, without learning from those mistakes and moving on. And to the extent that we can forgive ourselves, I think that that actually is part of the rejuvenation process and the refueling process. You know, it's not just brushing something aside. It's a deep realization that we're not perfect and that if we do our best, we are much more likely to be engaged. Because, you know, I always like to say, cracked but not broken, the art of human vulnerability, that every human being has some kind of vulnerability. And to the extent that we can recognize this, it's actually empowering to know our vulnerabilities rather than pretending not to have them, which actually makes us much more tense. So I do think that self-forgiveness is a critical piece of being a good tinkerer because it allows you to move on.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Other comments or questions?
Yes. This is Kelvin. I have a question relative to how your concept, which is very exciting, fits into someone applying the growth mindset where you have to look at your potential by making mistakes and reacting to those mistakes and learning from them, and that whole process of growth and learning through doing and experimenting.
I think that's a great question too. The book does very much relate to the growth mindset. And I would say that the concept that most relates to that is the concept that I called the possibility mindset. Now, we generally want to believe that we should do things that are probable and realistic. But in reality, when you work with top performers, to be the top performer is a low probability because it's one in however many other people in that same segment who can actually do what they need to do. As a result, having a possibility mindset, which is very much like a growth mindset, so is basically saying to your brain, look, I think this is possible to get to the next phase of where I need to get to. I don't know how to get there, and I don't know what needs to change for me to get there, but I want to get there. Your brain then stays online, and your unconscious tries to figure this out. If, however, you say to your brain, this is not possible, I don't know how to get there, your brain says, thank you, good night, I'm going to sleep. So the first thing to remember is the more you keep possibility online, the more likely you are to grow, because your unconscious brain will begin to design a solution even if you don't know what to do consciously. The second thing is that the possibility mindset is very much like a placebo mindset. So when studies were done where they gave people all the same cream and they labeled one tube lidocaine where people expected pain relief and the other tube was labeled capsaicin, the active ingredient in chili, and the third tube was labeled neutral, people who took the lidocaine, even though it was all the same cream, they expected positive things to happen, and they said, wow, this feels really calming. And when you looked in their brains, the reward center was activated. And those people who took the capsaicin thought that it stung, and if you looked in their brains, you saw that the pain center was activated. So believing in possibility, leaning into it, actually it increases your opioids and makes you less stressed, and it also increases dopamine and makes you more rewarded. So having a possibility mindset leads to growth by de-stressing you, by making you feel more rewarded, and also helping your unconscious brain come together to design solutions that you may not know consciously.
Kelvin, and there was another question at the same time as Kelvin. I want to come back and pick up on that.
This is Kip.
Kip, go ahead.
Yeah, you had mentioned that in the first part of your book that meditation was helpful for unfocusing. And the question is one-pointed awareness practices in meditation, especially in yoga, is that in keeping with allowing both the focused and unfocused mind in functioning?
Sure. So, yeah, I think the meditation question is complex from a number of perspectives. So I think one-pointed awareness, if you're just focusing on your breath for mindfulness, clearly that process starts with focus. But when the mind is then focused on the breath, for example, then you start to observe this kind of chatter in the brain. And so the brain's unfocus essentially gets activated. So the first thing I would say is that even one-pointed meditation leads to activation because by stilling the mind in a certain way, there are many other unfocused fragments of thought that begin to come up. The second thing I would say is that if you think, for example, of the stages of attention, I describe this in the book as the attentional triad, which is based on the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, which basically say that when you start focusing, you have focus on an object. Once you focus on that object, your attention begins to flow toward that object. And then after your attention flows, if you keep your attention one-pointed, you and that object become one. And in that state of integration is when we begin to feel the power of unfocus. Because then, rather than being a collection of things, we become a connection of things. And so in teams and even in our own lives, to the extent that we can pay attention deeply, we may start out with focus. But when unfocus occurs, where you and that person begin to merge because your understanding has merged, that is when unfocus begins to take over. With that said, I would also say that there have been some studies that show that mindfulness meditation is superior for analytic problem solving, whereas mind wandering, the kind of positive constructive daydreaming that I'm talking about, is actually useful for creative problem solving. So if you want to make a distinction up front, that may be one way to go. But I think going back to your original question, which is, does one-pointed meditation relate to unfocus? It does, because it starts with focus but leads to unfocus in a couple of different ways.
Thank you. So in integral yoga then, which is based on Patanjali's work, then concentration would be the focus part, and then the meditation would be going into the flow.
Right.
Got it. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Dr. Pillay, this is PJ in Houston. I was fascinated by your book. And I heard the example of Serena Williams going into the possibility from the probability of a loss here. And I like how you skillfully handled, quote-unquote, positive thinking and flipped the script to be possibility thinking, because that opens up a totally different way to look at it. Last thing I want to say is for the people who are skeptical of spiritual science, this gives firm evidence and a scientific basis for what we know as metaphysics. I just saw the connections. My synapses were firing all over the place, and I just want to thank you so much for this groundbreaking work.
Thank you so much for mentioning that. And I have to say there was a moment of tension between the editor and myself because she didn't want this to be a spiritual book when we started out. And I told her that I thought this was about the human condition and that spirituality is simply another way of navigating consciousness. And I don't feel like there is a disconnection between biology and spirituality because I think our biology supports spiritual explorations. It's simply a matter of introducing specific techniques so people can discover what is beyond their concrete minds and to connect to a greater whole. So thank you very much for recognizing that that was a really important points that I wanted to deliver through the book.
I have another question relative to connections. How can we motivate connections that are fragments of things that may help solve problems?
Sorry, so if I could just hear that again. How can we motivate connections?
Yeah, how can we?
That's a question.
How can we motivate connections to pieces of things that are fragmented around our brain, which will help us when we connect them together to solve problems?
Sure. So I think unfocus is a remarkable way to do that. And one of the theorists that I would lean on to answer your question, which I think is a fantastic question, which is in order to remain motivated, people will often say, I need to apply this effort to get to my goal. And they focus on the effort and the procedure, but they forget the I. So the I is essentially what I talked of as identity. And in order to improve your motivation, you have to be present in that motivation. Focus alone will get you the fork-like parts of your identity. Unfocus will help you invite other more complex parts of your identity and these fragments in. And by using one of these techniques, like positive constructive daydreaming, or doodling, or napping, or psychological Halloweenism, or possibility thinking, or walking in the way we talked about it, these fragments will then come to the fore, and the self will then be more complete. That's the first thing that I would say. I would say the second thing about motivation is that motivation is an assimilation of not just abstractions. In order to be motivated, we need to accept our paradoxes, we need to accept our fragments, and we need to accept our symbols. And Wilfred Bion, who was a British psychoanalyst, talked about the fact that in addition to our coherent narratives, there are these fragments in our brain, which he called beta elements. And what he said was that even though they are fragments, they have to be bound by a force. And many theorists have called this force libido, which is this kind of motivational energy we conventionally associate it with sex and aggression. But actually, it's got to do with this fundamental motivational energy that can bind fragments within our psyche. So what happens is when libido is present, the fragments are bound, and we operate as a whole. Our paradoxes, our contradictions are all part of us, and we accept them, and as a result, we can feel motivated. So, for example, people will say, I love my children, but I hate my life, because they're overwhelmed. But some people will not want to accept the fact that they have these paradoxes within them, and as a result, they actually have difficulty proceeding in their lives. Now, when libido is depleted, then these fragments do not are not contained, and as a result, many theorists have said that this will express itself symptomatically, not just psychologically, but potentially physically as well. And so part of what we need to do is learn how to interact with this motivational energy or libido. And what unfocused does is rather than constraining or suppressing or repressing how the mind is proceeding, unfocused regulates the unfocused circuit, the default mode circuit, and then allows these different fragments to be bound by the energy because it releases this libidinal energy.
Wow, we are going to have to stop. Sarini, who would have guessed that you could have integrated a shadow story of a couple of psychoanalysts in this conversation? Thank you so much. It is a privilege to have you with us and discuss your elegant work and to share what you do every day and bring it into such practical applications. Thank you so very much. I appreciate
it. Thank you very much.
I know I speak for our group.
Thanks so much. Thanks for inviting me to share this with you and with the group. I really appreciate it.
Our privilege. Bye now.
Bye. Take care.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dave.
Absolutely. See you guys now.
Magnificent.
Thank you, David.
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you.